Okay, so basically we had some interruptions. Last week we talked about Tu B'Shvat and a little bit about Judaism and the environment. We will actually come back to that a little later as well. So you'll hear a part two on some of that. Let me just mention as an aside, although it's not the topic for tonight, that one very interesting aspect of how we relate to the environment, I don't know if anyone here has a good statistical background. I hope not, because you'll know much more than me on it. But one of the difficult halachic issues is this. There is a halachic principle, generally, and the principle sounds very simple, but in a way it almost doesn't make sense. You're not supposed to do dangerous things. There is such a rule. You're not supposed to do dangerous things. There's a whole siman in the Shulchan Aruch. In fact, it's the very last chapter in the whole Shulchan Aruch, that a person has a responsibility to take care of their life, and they are not supposed to do what are called dangerous activities. This is derived biblically from the mitzvah called ma'akeh. Anyone knows what ma'akeh is? That if you have a flat roof, you are obligated to build a fence around your roof so that people shouldn't fall off the roof when they walk around and the like. But what Chazal often do is Chazal generalize. Right. In other words, the biblical mitzvah is very specific. Build a makkah. But Chazal extrapolate. They generalize from that principle. In fact, a similar development was about not destroying things. When the Torah says don't destroy, that's a very specific thing. That says in time of war, do not destroy a fruit-bearing tree. But what do? Chazal generalize it that you don't waste things for non-productive reasons. So similarly here, the mitzvah of ma'akeh has been generalized to refer to a general rule that one is not supposed to needlessly endanger themselves. Now that sounds good, but then you start thinking, well, what does that mean? I'm not supposed to endanger myself? Well, every time I walk out of my house, I'm endangering myself. Every time I cross the street, certainly in Israel, I don't just mean because of the Arabs. I'm talking about whatever it would be. And even staying in bed is not a guarantee. You know, in Washington, D.C., where there were a lot of drug wars and the like, I remember reading several years ago that a child in a bad neighborhood literally got killed. He was lying in bed, crossfire between drug gangs and the cheap apartment buildings that the bullet just goes through the wall. The kid gets killed lying sleeping in bed, you know. And no one was even intending to kill him. He was just in the crossfire of gangs, whatever it is. So obviously, when we say, thou shalt not do dangerous things, we have to qualify it, because life is dangerous, right? When they say life is a terminal condition, as it were. So we add maybe an unhelpful modifier. Don't do excessively dangerous things. Don't do unreasonably dangerous things. Okay, that's fine. But then, of course, you get into what is the halachic definition of what is called an unreasonable danger. So here, halacha works in some ways in a circular way. This is always a surprise. This pops up a number of times in the halachic system, and it's always a little surprising, in which Hashem's will, the halacha is Hashem's will. Hashem's will kind of gets defined the way people interpret it, and that is those types of dangers that are commonly accepted in society as the normal way of living, halacha says you are allowed to do. So the classic example would be driving or taking a bus. Now, statistically, driving has a certain danger, right? A certain percentage of people in cars, and sometimes it could be relatively high, are going to get into life-threatening accidents. People are going to get killed. So every time, I don't want to scare anybody, every time you go into a car, you can get killed. But since normal society considers driving and going on a bus as the average thing that people do, so halacha itself says it is not considered to be unreasonably dangerous. You are allowed, to put it another way, you are allowed to rely on divine protection. And the Gemara quotes a verse in Tehillim, Shomer Pisoyim Hashem, which means Hashem protects foolish people. Meaning you are, you know, you say you're foolish for doing it, but if this is what people commonly do. Now, On the other hand, things that are not considered common activities, like bungee jumping and the like, might be considered excessively dangerous because it's not yet common. Now, what's unusual about that idea is
statistically speaking, very safe.
Right. That's the thing. So one of the questions is this. What if something is an unusual activity, but it's as safe or even safer than a usual activity? So I'm going to make up a number because I don't have the numbers here, but I'm just going to make up numbers, so I'm just using it for illustration. Let's say that one out of 5,000 people get killed in a traffic accident, and for bungee jumping, it's one out of 7,000 people. Again, my numbers are just made up, but all right. So bungee jumping is unusual, and people have a perception of it as very dangerous. But in fact, it is safer than activities that people do every day. So do I say, well, if it's not a usual thing, can't do it because it's dangerous? And even if it's less dangerous than cars, but cars are accepted, that's not accepted? Or do you make the argument that anything that has a risk that is better than, safer than or equal to something that is commonly accepted will automatically be okay? Actually, this would be a machlokas. It's not so simple. On the other hand, what is clear is activities that are more dangerous than those that are accepted would fall under this provision. Now, one interesting thing that comes to mind is, I haven't seen a detailed analysis of this, is skiing, I think, potentially, could be that type of example. Now, skiing is not highly dangerous, but for beginners, it can be dangerous. In fact, even with bungee jumping, I'd like to look. Bungee jumping is safe, but I'd like to see the different rates between beginners. Of course, a beginner, if it doesn't work out, that will also be the last. because you're factoring in a whole bunch of people, from a very experienced to people who, I assume that most accidents happen to people kind of in the beginning of their...
No, because in bungee jumping, it has nothing to do with beginner or advanced, because they do all the tying up for you. Whether we're skiing, you have some sort of control. So if you're not experienced, then you would actually be in danger.
Okay. I remember Now, the truth is, even yeshivas, so the yeshivas have ski trips and the like, and this is part of an outreach thing. I know my own yeshiva, Or Sameach, I was invited to go. I didn't go for that one, but they actually had a ski trip in Utah. But halakhically, I think skiing may raise certain issues. The one time I went skiing, I remember just once, many years ago, I went on the beginners of beginner of beginner beginner hill. And they didn't even have a ski lift. They had just, a rope that you put up. But that was mighty hard. I couldn't figure out. You hold it too tightly, the top where your body goes and the bottom, whatever. I could not figure out how to get up. So I remember there was this, 7-year-old kid or 8-year-old kid. He was going up and down the slope, 10 times. And I did not manage to get up, back up. So he finally says, "Can I help you, mister?" One of those things. Okay. Anyway, so that was my end of my skiing trip. But still, halacha. So certainly a beginner slope is not a sakana, but some of the big ones potentially might be. But here's something else. And again, this has a lot of ramifications. If one really takes this seriously, as we should, it deals with health, with exercise, with diet, with the type of food that you eat. It is very, very relevant on the smoking issue. Does halacha, Baruch Hashem, smoking has gone down even in Israel. Israel, the rate of smoking still is much higher than a lot of countries, but it's gone down a lot. And once again, 100 years ago, maybe 150 years ago, when smoking was touted not only as not dangerous, but smoking was touted as having health benefits. If you looked at advertisements for smoking in the, let's say, the 1930s, it would talk about aiding digestion and calming you down, which of course actually it does. Some of that it actually does and the like. And it was advertised as healthy. And then later, of course, in the 1960s, we had the Surgeon General's report. And the question immediately becomes, does halacha permit a person to smoke? Are you doing something dangerous? Now here, though, I want to point out a very, very fascinating halachic issue. And again, I'm going to make up numbers because I don't have the numbers, but I just want to illustrate the conceptual issue. And that is, Mark Twain once said that there are lies and there are damn lies, and then there are statistics, meaning statistics can be the greatest form of deception. And the problem is, in assessing dangerousness of behavior, are you looking at the magnitude of the risk or the objective level of the risk? Well, let me explain what this is. And again, I'm going to make up numbers. I just don't have the numbers, but I think you'll see the point. Let's imagine that a given pesticide, right? Without a pesticide, the natural occurrence of a cancer might be 1 in 1,000,000. With the pesticide, it might be 1 in 100,000. Now, there are two ways a statistician, or a politician for that matter, could describe the effect of the pesticide. And depending on how you describe it, it either sounds real scary, or it doesn't sound that scary. One way of describing it is, 1 out of 100,000 people that are going to use this product are going to get cancer. Well, that doesn't sound that bad. That's safer than driving. That's safer than a lot of things. Another way of saying it is, use of this pesticide increases the risk of cancer by 1,000%. Which is true, right? You see? Because 1 in 1,000,000 to 1 in 100,000 is a 10 times increase. A tenfold increase is 1,000%. That sounds pretty bad. 1,000%. So, the way we would describe it is, this pesticide greatly increases the magnitude of the risk over what it was, but objectively, the risk is still relatively small. You see the issue? So the question is, when halacha says, don't do dangerous things, is halacha referring to don't do things that greatly increase the magnitude of the risk? Or does halacha only limit itself to things that have a very high risk? And 1 out of 100,000 is not necessarily such a very high risk, because it's within the risk of many other things that we do. Now, even cigarette smoking, to some degree, it's a little more complicated because cigarette smoking has other complications besides lung cancer and emphysema, but just looking at the biggies, like lung cancer and emphysema. So smoking greatly, greatly, greatly increases the risk of emphysema and lung cancer.
Smoking against halacha?
Well, no, actually most have not said it's against halacha. Most poskim have been, they've waffled on it. They've said, do not start. You're not supposed to start. But they have not, most have not said that people have to stop. Now, maybe because we don't issue psakim that people are unable to keep.
Can you smoke occasionally?
Well, theoretically you could, if it's controllable that way. Once again, the problem with addictive behavior, you know, even marijuana, you know, people ask me, can I smoke marijuana occasionally? I mean, don't remember, shouldn't take this. I will deny it, but the truth of the matter is, you can't really make, there's no halachic argument, other than law of the land, which is real. There is no halachic argument that occasional marijuana is a problem.
Does it have to be kosher?
Well, marijuana doesn't have to be kosher, but you know, the OU has certified medical marijuana because they're baking it in brownies. Cakes and cookies, or brownies. So, you know, marijuana itself doesn't have to be kosher, but if you're making it in a cake, you know, you need to. It's all controversy now that the people are criticizing the OU for certifying marijuana as kosher. But okay. But the point is, from a strict, if I was sitting here as a strict halachic person, I can't sit down and tell you a concrete reason why occasional marijuana is a halachic issue. But once again, you know, I know this is all controversial, but you know, is it a gateway to other drugs? Does it cause addiction? Does it make you part of a drug culture which has all sorts of negative effects? So obviously, it's something you keep away from. But if you know, but once in a while, somebody has a joint, you know, and I can't. And there's no way I could say they're committing a sin. They're going to go to Gehenna, you know, for that.
But,
and,
if it's medical, like, but if it's medical, then it's
for the medical for sure. It's okay. I mean,
if so, what if someone self-medicates themselves?
Well,
you know, I mean, listen, you know, you could fool me, but you can't fool God. If you have a genuine medical need,
yeah,
then you do what you need to do, you know. But if you're using it as a pretense for other things, Hashem knows. What can I tell you? I mean,
but in a sense, yeah, you don't need a prescription.
Well, that's the law of the land. I mean, listen, theoretically, and again, the law of the land is an issue. There is an issue. We're not supposed to violate.
Yeah.
But putting aside the law of the land, if you have studied your condition and your judgment is a good judgment, there's no magical halacha that it has to be through a prescription. I wouldn't call that a halachic requirement. But you need to know what you're doing, obviously. So this issue about smoking, about other issues, is a big issue, and that is, things may have magnitude of risk, but it's still the case that most people who smoke are not going to get lung cancer. In fact, for 50 years, this is how tobacco companies avoided being sued. I mean, basically, recently they, you know, in the past decade, they've been liable for billions and billions of dollars, but successfully the trial lawyers won all of the cases against the tobacco company by basically saying, hey, you know, who said he got cancer because he smoked? He smoked and he got cancer, but who says one caused the other? They won with that argument. They basically said, happens to be, just like, you know, a person ate spaghetti and got cancer, you're not going to say, you know, spaghetti caused the cancer.
Correlation doesn't imply causality.
That's correct. Who says? And they won. They won with that case. They won 50 years. Nobody was able to get any judgment against the tobacco companies.
But you can't deny that it does have health implications.
For sure.
That there is proof of the fact that it does start to destroy your lungs, and like the fact that
yes,
tar.
Yes, yes. No, I do understand.
So my thing is, that you see so often, I'm not saying like that they're promoting it, or, but you see many times in like yeshivas and like bachurs nowadays, today, like when you know these issues, why is something not...
Well, the one thing I will tell you this, again, it's a bit of a waffling, because if you really took the position that cigarette smoking is dangerous, we would have to order people to stop. We don't do that, or the rabbi, great gedolim, don't do that, but what they do is they say, if you haven't started yet, do not start, because it's not a good thing. So it's kind of a waffle psak in a sense. But yeah, I think there is a strong inclination to heavily discourage smoking, and it's gone down a little bit in Israel. And there's also a sensitivity to secondhand smoke. Secondhand smoke has been recognized in halacha as well, that even if I'm smoking, because, you know, I decide I want to smoke, but if I'm exposing you to smoke, number one, it's an issue of comfort. I'm not allowed to create things that are unpleasant for you. But number two, more importantly than the comfort, is an issue of health, because breathing in smoke can also be... injurious to a person, and even if it's not life-threatening, it doesn't have to be. You're getting, you know, cancer from it. Even the just, you know, difficult to breathe or whatever, that is enough. In fact, there's all sorts of halachas. You know, you're not allowed to. It all depends on what the standard climate is. You know, during the winter, I'm not allowed to come into the room and open a window if people don't want it. And during the summer, you know, I'm not allowed to shut off the air conditioning. In other words, there's kind of a standard that applies depending on the season, and the individual minority gets inconvenienced. But I think I told you, I think I may have mentioned this, that I was asked, also secondhand, I was not asked directly, but about a guy who was sensitive to secondhand smoke, and he was at a wedding in Me'ez Sharim where people smoke, and he just went over to an old guy and ripped a cigarette out of his mouth and put it out. I thought, I didn't think that was, you know, I don't advocate that type of behavior, but be it as it may, it is actually against even the Israeli law to smoke in wedding halls. You have to kind of...
Wait, can you repeat the part within the summer? You can't turn off the AC if one person is hot? I mean, cold?
Yeah, that's correct. That's correct.
And in the winter, if one person is cold, you're not allowed to turn off
the heat. Turn off the heat. That's correct. That's correct. Because there is...
Yeah.
But you try to...
Can we record and put that on WhatsApp? Because we're having always...
No. Again, you try to come to a compromise about this. You know, you don't turn off the heat, but you can lower the heat in a way that people will be, as many people will be comfortable. But there is kind of a concept that in winter, the norm is to have heat. So one person can say, I want there to be heat. In the summer, the norm, at least today, is to have air conditioning. So even one person can say, I want the air conditioning. That's kind of it, because there is a norm. But still, you try in all of these matters, you try to have shalom, you try to come to a compromise position and the like. And if someone has a sickness or an unusual condition, then they certainly should be accommodated. But even if it's just they want the normal standard, you know, the individual is allowed to make that judgment. But as I say, this is a big issue, the issue of magnitude of risk when something is still relatively small objectively. Does the Torah prohibit it? Another issue, again, I'm just throwing it out, in risk assessment, is what you might call cost benefits. And again, this is a difficult public policy issue, but halacha connects with public policy here. And that is, let's take a pesticide as an example. Let's imagine that a pesticide increases the risk of cancer 1,000%, from 1 in a million to 1 in 100,000. But at the same time, the pesticide will increase the crop yield 10 times. Let's say it's Africa or something. So what's going to happen is, without the pesticide, you'll have thousands of people who might die of starvation who will live as a result of the increased crop yield, but only at the expense of more people dying of cancer. So you see, it's not so simple to simply say, oh, I can't use the pesticide because it increases the risk of cancer by 1,000%. But it doesn't just go one way. Not using the pesticide increases the risk of starvation by 1,000%. So the question is, are you allowed or even commanded to do dangerous activities that will actually save lives? Or maybe this is similar, to draw an analogy. Remember the case, we had this case a lot of times. The non-Jewish army surrounds a city, and they say, give us a Jew to kill, or we will kill you all. So the halacha is, we're not supposed to deliver one person to save other people. You don't kill one person to save another person, or even to save a lot of people. So maybe that's the same calculus. I don't have the right to condemn X number of people to cancer in order to save Y number of people from starvation. Because in a sense, I would then be making a choice to save some lives over other lives. You see? So this is not simple. This is not at all simple. And what it really tells you is, this highlights the idea that, and this comes up in many, many areas, that in order to paskin a halacha correctly, you really have to be familiar with the facts on the ground, including statistical analysis, including cost benefit, and as you don't need to be an expert, but you at least need to be in consultation with an expert to understand this. You see? Because it's very, very rare that something is simply dangerous with no compensating advantage on the other side. Pesticides have many compensating advantages, although they have many dangers. And particularly in parts of the world, like Africa, where there is widespread starvation, pesticides have resulted in many, many people staying alive who otherwise would have died. But again, but then you have to factor in the people that died because of the pesticides, right? So that's a big issue. Now, of course, the truth of the matter is, if the world would simply be a more just place, you wouldn't need all of this, because in truth, there is enough food in the world to feed the world. But the problem is, it doesn't get distributed because of politics and other things. So in truth, you know, you could take from here and bring to there, but things break down. So we have to come into pesticides and other dangerous ways, genetic modification, even genetic modifications. Genetic modifications, we discover more and more those risks without getting into, the European Union, who are not great lovers of Israel, so I don't like to, use the European Union as any authority in anything. But as many of you might know, if you are into these environmental issues, the European Union prohibits a lot of so-called genetically modified food. In the United States and Israel, we don't even know what's been genetically modified. They just give it to us, and the jury's out. We don't really know, but some people suspect that it's linked to disease and linked to other things. And yet, genetic modification has greatly enhanced production of food. So you could say, I don't have the numbers, but you could say that there are people who are alive who didn't die of starvation because of these enhancements. So this is a very, very serious issue. So on one hand, it's a simple rule: don't do things that are dangerous. But when you start thinking about it, it's a quite complicated issue. And that is why a good posek, one who decides Jewish law in these areas, will always have a cadre of experts that they can talk to, whether it's electrical engineers about Shabbos, about refrigerators and ovens, whether it's health epidemiologists, just about disease and cost-benefit. Because otherwise you have the phenomenon, perhaps it's irreverent for me to use this expression, but in Psak Halacha as well, there's a phenomenon called garbage in and garbage out, meaning to say the Psak Halacha is only as good as the facts that are presented to the rabbi and that are understood by the rabbi. If the rabbi has the wrong factual information, then even if the halachic analysis is 100% correct, the answer is not going to be correct. It will not be God's will, because it is answering the wrong questions. A very simple example. Yom Kippur. If somebody's life is in danger, the halach is clear, you eat on Yom Kippur. But if the rabbi, in other words, but whether the person's in danger is not a halachic question, it's a medical question. So if the rabbi paskins that the patient is in danger when he's not, he's violating Yom Kippur. If the rabbi paskins the patient was not in danger when he was, the rabbi could be a murderer. Right? So the halacha depends on the accuracy of the facts. Okay, so that's just, I just wanted to continue, just finish off a little bit with that risk assessment, to be aware of the complexity of the question. I don't know if anyone here is studying public health or the like, but these are the types of issues that you will look into in public health. Okay, so now let's go back to our main topic, which was a few weeks ago already. It's been a while. We were discussing the parameters of the Aguna problem, and this is an issue that I can spend many, many weeks on. I don't want to spend too many weeks on it. But it's a topic I've been involved in for many, many, many years. In fact, I wrote a book on it. Very expensive. You can get it on Amazon, but I wouldn't bother. It's too expensive. It's like $80 or something. But
Why is it so expensive? Your
book. Well, yeah, my book. Yeah. It's called The Plight of the Aguna, Between Religious and Civil Law, The Plight of the Aguna.
It's an academic book.
That's the problem. They were marketing it as a college textbook.
Do you know the organization? Yeah. Aura?
I know Aura, yeah. Organization for the Resolution of Aguna.
Yeah, my sister, doesn't work for them, but she has, a fellowship with them.
Okay. So we're gonna talk about Aura a little bit, because Aura has been involved in very lately in some bit of a controversial issues, and we'll talk about that, but yeah, sure. The founder of Aura is Rabbi Jeremy Stern, who just made Aliyah, last year. He lives in Ramat Beit Shemesh. But the organization is still based in the United States. Aura does a lot of demonstrations in front of recalcitrant husbands. They do demonstrations, right, and they put pressure and the like, and they've obtained, they claim, and I believe them, that they have obtained 250 gets gittin from husbands who refused to give gittin to their wives. So they actually freed, as they call it, they freed 250 women. And most of them are without event, but there's a 251st woman that raises tremendous halachic issues that are really worldwide. That is one out of all of the other, one of these women did not get a get, but she got an annulment, and that's raising a tremendous outcry in the halachic world. I'll discuss that, the issue of annulment and the like. Okay, so again, the basic idea we very much know that the divorce procedure of the Torah is a very, very simple procedure. The husband or his agent, he doesn't have to be in person, the husband or his agent, or the wife or her agent, come together.
Are these only Jew to Jew?
Jew to Jew, yeah. Okay, let me be sure everyone knows this. Marriage between a guy and a Jew, and it makes no difference, Jewish man, non-Jewish woman, or non-Jewish man and Jewish woman, is halachically not a marriage. It is not a marriage. It's not only a sin, but it's not a marriage. As a result, there is no need.
It's an actual negative mitzvah?
Well, it's a zero. It's a zero. It is considered to be sinful, but more than being sinful, I mean, any intercourse between a Jew and a non-Jew is sinful. Non-Jew, of course, I mean, who didn't convert, is sinful, but it's also a nullity. See, that's not always the case. Let me give you an example. If a Kohen marries a divorced woman, that is a sinful marriage, but it is a valid marriage. What do I mean by valid? If they dissolve it, as they should, they must go through the get ceremony. So sometimes you have sinful marriages that are still, after the fact, valid and need a get. But Jew and non-Jew is a zero. There is no get. As soon as the civil divorce, both parties are free to move on. So a get is only if both parties are Jewish, either Jewish by birth or Jewish by conversion, of course.
They have to get divorced if a Kohen marries a divorced woman.
They do.
It's
yes.
Against halacha, so they have to.
They have to get divorced. They have to get divorced. But the point I'm making is they need a divorce. They need a get, meaning they don't just say, oh, it's a sinful marriage, so it's nothing. They actually need a get. But Jew to Goy don't need a get at all. Don't need a get. Okay. But when there is, yeah.
If a Kohen marries a guy, has a daughter, she converts a Bas Kohen?
No. Because once again, if a Kohen marries a guy, the child is, of course, born non-Jewish. Mm-hmm. And once they convert, conversion destroys any lineage. So she has no, halachically, she has no parents at all, halachically. So she's not a Bas Kohen. That's correct. Okay. In truth, even if a Kohen marries a converted woman, so technically the woman is a Bas Kohen, she doesn't have the holiness of Kahuna, because whenever a Kohen marries a forbidden woman, the Kahuna stops. If they have a son, the son is not a Kohen. Right? So if a Kohen marries a convert, if a Kohen marries a divorced woman, if a Kohen marries a woman that had intercourse with a Gentile, the child is not a Kohen. The child is called a Chalal. Chalal means a desecrated Kohen. Now, there's nothing wrong with being a Chalal. He's not a Mamzer. A Chalal is a regular Jew, but he's not a Kohen. That's the important thing. The Kahuna does not, which is a funny thing, because the Kohen that did the sin is still a Kohen. It's very, very, very funny that the one who did the bad thing does not forfeit his Kahuna, but he is prevented from passing it down.
What if he then divorces her and gets married to someone
who's okay?
Yeah.
So their children are kohanim.
Oh, really?
That's correct. Wow. That's correct. A kohen marries a divorced woman or a woman that had intercourse with a non-Jew. She doesn't have to be a virgin, but if she had intercourse with a non-Jew, their children are not kohanim. But if the kohen divorces that improper marriage and marries a kosher woman for him, then their kids are kohanim. So you can have half brothers from the same father. Some are Kohanim and some are Chalalim. Now a Chalal is not a Mamzer. It's not a Mamzer. He can marry other Jews, but he's not a Kohen.
What does the word mean, Chalal?
Chalal means desecrated. So the phrase of someone, it's the same word as the Islamic kosher, Chalal. But yeah,
that's what I was thinking.
But it's different. It's almost the opposite meaning. There, Chalal means pure.
Kosher.
Here, Chalal means desecrated. Like Chilul Shabbat or Chilul Hashem, desecrating God's name, same word, yeah.
Is there any way for going to lose their status themselves?
A person who was an actual, born as a kosher Kohen, cannot lose his status. He can only prevent his children from having his status by marrying these improper women. But he cannot resign his status or the like. Now, I will say there is what you might call a temporary suspension of his status. So, for example, if a Kohen is married to a divorced woman, we do not give him priestly honors until he divorces that woman. So he will not be called first to the Torah. He will not be allowed to duchen, to recite the priestly blessing. But that's really more in the nature of trying to force him to do what he needs to do. But he technically is a Kohen, even though he will not be given honors until he divorces that woman.
But if she slept with a non-Jew, then the whole community, they would know that.
Well, I wouldn't say that.
They don't call him up because it's a sinful marriage.
Oh, yeah, well, no. No, that's correct. And they'll know that. Well, yes, okay.
Yeah.
There is a concept. It's not in vogue today, but there is somewhat of a concept of shaming people who publicly sin against the community and against the Torah. Mm. Again, today we tend to be softer, but a person's a sinner. We're not going to give him the honors in the synagogue. That's relatively gentle. There are worse things that we could do. We could excommunicate. We could say you're not allowed to be within his four amos. That's what happened to Spinoza. Right? You've heard of Spinoza. Spinoza was a very, very famous philosopher who grew up as an Orthodox religious Jew, but he became a real heretic. Spinoza was a heretic who denied, he came to the conclusion that God didn't give the Torah, and he taught these ideas. And the Jewish community of Amsterdam excommunicated him. This was a very, very terrifying ceremony. In the middle of the night, they lit candles, and they had 400 shofars that they blew, and they extinguished all the candles. It was pitch dark, and they blew 400 shofars.
Wow.
And I've read the text of it. It's a terrifying excommunication that, he will be in hell forever. Really, like a big, big speech, and he was only like 23. And so they were tough in those days. Today, so not to have an aliyah is relatively minor. It's not such a big deal. By the way, there's some discussion. Some people want the rabbinate of Amsterdam to revoke the ban of excommunication on Spinoza. I mean, it happened 300.
Really,
it happened 350 years ago, but they feel that
maybe stuck in
Gehenna. Why do they feel that?
Huh? Well, the problem basically is Spinoza is not much worse than most conservative Reformed Jews. In other words, Spinoza at the time was extremely radical, breaking away, from the monolithic religious community. But Spinoza's ideas are, unfortunately, I'm not saying it's a good thing, unfortunately, the mainstream of non-Orthodox Jews essentially subscribe to Spinoza's ideas. So they say, hey, most Jews are not from. I'm not defending. I'm just saying, most Jews are not from. So why should Spinoza be singled out?
Happened. I mean, what would be the point of revoking
him? Well, the problem is that those who are less sensitive to religion point out that Spinoza is a world, is a world famous philosopher, and they, from their perspective, they say it's a blot of shame that the Jewish people, don't give him the respect that the entire world gives him.
It already happened.
Yeah, but they say, but this way we would show that, I'm not defending it, I'm just saying, but their argument is that we should embrace someone that is so respected in the world. I mean, symbolism. Now, you are right, though. Spiritually, you're also correct, that, we don't really know what Hashem does when, God forbid, people are placed in these excommunications. And it could very well be that annulling an excommunication after somebody died could take the person out of Gehenna. You know, there are things that could happen that we're not fully aware of. But this was scary. This was one of the worst. I mean, I've seen other bans of excommunication. Usually they're, you know, we won't talk to you for until you do tshuva, something like that. But this was really, this talked about heavenly punishments and all sorts of things. Very, very scary, yeah.
So is there like a rabbinic process for excommunication?
Yes, there actually is. Sure. It's very rarely done, very rarely done. Although the wall posters here, you'd think it's done all the time. Everyone's always, if you walk by the wall posters, I don't know if you read them, everybody's always putting other people into excommunication. But it's, you know, the wall posters...
Are those big wild ones?
No, it's a mix. A lot of it is advertisement, a lot of it is funeral notices. That's probably the most common. And some of them are the occasional excommunication. If you have an iPhone, you know, it'll say, you know,
and the person's name is on the paper.
No, it's always anonymous. The committee for Torah, you know, it never says anybody's name. It just says the committee for Torah excommunicates people who have iPhones. Okay, whatever. But if you're talking about a full-fledged formal ceremony, yeah, there is a ceremony of excommunication. It's very, very rarely invoked.
It's from the Torah.
Well, it's from the Talmud. The Torah doesn't explain it so explicitly, but the Talmud has a whole section on excommunication, on bans.
Has it ever happened in Israel?
A full fledged? I don't think so. I don't think it's happened in Israel yet. I mean, but you know, you have these informal bans which don't mean very much. Even internet use, you know, they say you're not allowed to use. You know, but those are not full-fledged bans in that way. In fact, it's interesting that the Talmud even gives a story where, you know, if you see somebody doing a big avera, you can excommunicate them. So the story goes, a whole story about Reish Lakish, the great Rabbi Rav Shimon ben Lakish.
The one that was running towards the pond.
Yeah. Well, Reish Lakish was initially a highway robber. He was but after he became
rabbi.
Let me go back to tell you the story because it's an interesting story. Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, his early years, he was actually a robber. He would attack people. He was a highway robber, and he once attacked the great Rabbi Rav Yochanan, and he wanted to rob him. And when Rav Yochanan saw how powerful Reish Lakish was, he jumped and swam, he did all sorts of very physically demanding things. He said, a man like you should devote your strength to Torah study. So Shimon ben Lakish, who was not a religious person obviously, said to Rav Yochanan, who was very handsome, very beautiful, says, a man like you should give your beauty to women, become a male prostitute. That's how he spoke to him. So Rav Yochanan said, oh, if you think I'm beautiful, you should meet my sister, who's much more beautiful than I am. And if you do tshuva, you can get to marry my sister. These stories, the sister is never consulted. So Rav Shimon ben Lakish does tshuva, and he marries Rav Yochanan's sister. And he becomes one of the great, great rabbis. In fact, throughout, maybe you've seen it in your own Gemara learning, that Rav Yochanan and Rav Shimon ben Lakish, they argue. Their relationship is called Talmid Chaver. Talmid Chaver means a student, but also a colleague. Reish Lakish was kind of like an equal with Rav Yochanan. But they had very different personalities. Rav Shimon ben Lakish was still very, very rough and tough, kind of an aggressive personality. And every time Rav Yochanan said something in Shir, Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish would ask 24 questions to try to refute Rav Yochanan. Rav Shimon ben Lakish, we call Reish Lakish. Reish is just Rabbi Shimon. Reish Lakish. Reish Lakish died before Rav Yochanan. And when Reish Lakish died, they replaced him with another student who every time Rav Yochanan said something, the student gave 24 reasons that Rav Yochanan was right. So Rav Yochanan started crying and sobbing. He said he missed Reish Lakish. So they said, why do you miss Reish Lakish? Every time you said something, Reish Lakish gave you 24 problems. Here you have a yes man, a person that says, you're right. So Rav Yochanan said, I didn't need a student to tell me that I'm right. But when Reish Lakish would challenge me, it forced me to think and develop my points. And if I was wrong, I would change my mind. If I was right, we came to a deeper understanding. So this was Reish Lakish. But the reason I'm mentioning him is nothing to do with that, actually, just to give you the biography, is that one time he encountered a ganav, a robber, who was stealing fruit from a garden. So Rav Shimon ben Lakish says, I'm excommunicating you because you're a ganav. So the ganav said back, theft is not one of the offenses for which you get excommunication, and therefore I'm excommunicating you because there is a sin to wrongfully excommunicate somebody. So the Gemara actually says Reish Lakish got himself into excommunication by wrongfully excommunicating the bad guy. It's like when the police come and they arrest the person who reports the thief, whatever it would be. So apparently excommunication used to be more common, but you see, it wasn't like the Spinoza excommunication. It was just, until you do tshuva, you're excommunicated, and as soon as you do tshuva, you're going to be okay, and the like. So that's an excommunication that doesn't have to last very long. It could last a day. Or whatever it would be. Okay. I don't know how... Oh, okay, okay. But now let's go back to the get procedure. So the get procedure is fairly simple. A sofer writes a document in Aramaic. It's 12 lines, standard text. The only thing that is unusual, tailor-made in the get, is we have to have the exact names. Let's say, I, husband, right? I, husband, give to wife. So when it says I husband in Aramaic, so you have to have every single name that the husband uses. So if the husband is Avraham, who goes by the name Avi, who goes by the English name Abe, it will actually say Avraham, who is known as Avi, who is known as Abe, son of Yerachmiel, who is known as Charlie, you have to know how to spell that, who is known as Chuck, hereby gives the document to Sarah, who is known as Suri, who is known as Sally, daughter of, right, and it doesn't say her mother, but it says
so
her father.
Every nickname.
So the Beis Din has to sit for a while and say, what do they call you at work? What do they call you at school? You have to know English names. And nicknames and English names. And English names are difficult to spell in Hebrew. Mm-hmm. Not so easy. Because the Hebrew does not naturally have certain sounds. Like Charlie. Or Cheryl. How do you spell a C-H, right? C-H is
Sorry.
Not...
A, huh?
Well, that's what they do. That's a convention. But the question is, a get does not use, marks, right? A get has to work with the aleph base. We don't put in punctuations like that. So they have a combination of a dalid, zayin, shin, dzh. So if you say it quickly, it's dzh, etc. Hebrew naturally, at least the way we pronounce it today, except for Yemenites, we don't have a soft G. George. Right? Now they have these marks, etc., but they're not halachic marks per se. Right? So there are a lot of sounds in Hebrew. TH, Theresa, or Teresa you pronounce it, but let's say there's a TH sound. Right? How do you pronounce it, etc.? Theodore. So in Hebrew, Theodore is written with a test, Theodore. But in a get you try to approximate the pronunciation. So there's a whole subspecialty in halacha. It may not sound like the most interesting field, but there are experts in the Beis Din whose main job is they determine the spelling of all of these names. Right? They're the experts in names. How do you spell these names in Hebrew? It's not such an easy thing. Since a get does not use any of the those marks that we have in invitations and the like. Okay, but other than that, other than the names, every get is the same 12 lines. Husband gives the document to his wife. As soon as she receives the document, she is now divorced. She walks with it for 4 amos, 8 feet. She gives it back to the Beis Din, which keeps the original get in its records. They also exit, so it shouldn't be used again by some other couple with the same name. Like there may be another Avram called Abe, etc. And the get cannot be used by another couple. It can only be used for the couple that it was written for. So they exit and they keep it in a locked record. And what the woman gets instead is she gets a letter, which is not a get, but the letter is just signed by the Beis Din saying that she did receive a get and she is allowed to marry anyone that she wants, except of course a Kohen. But she has to wait 90 days. A woman cannot marry until the 91st day after she receives a get. Can anyone know why that's so? That's correct. That in the days before there were pregnancy tests, the fear might be that the divorced woman might be pregnant. And what's going to happen is, let's say she marries, and 7 months later she has a child. Is this a premature child of husband number two? Or is it a full term from husband number one? And we wouldn't know who the father is. So to avoid that problem, the rabbis enacted that a woman must wait 3 months. This is whether she's widowed or divorced. Widowed or divorced, because we would assume that by the end of the first trimester, a pregnancy would be detectable. So if she's pregnant, we'll know that it's from the first husband. If she's not pregnant, we know that any child born will be from the second husband. There is a big, big contemporary machlokas. If today we could dispense with the 3 months by virtue of pregnancy tests, or what if the woman had a hysterectomy? What if she can't have a child? Right? Is this kind of an automatic rule no matter what? Or in cases where it's absolutely clear she's not pregnant, we don't have to enforce it. What if she's 85 years old? What are we going to say? Does an 85-year-old woman have to wait 3 months before she gets married because maybe she's pregnant? There's sari menu, are you choshesh? These are technical questions. And of course, today anyway, you really wouldn't have a mix-up who the father is because we have DNA testing. So even if a child is born 7 months into the second marriage and it's only 9 months from the divorce, we would still know, right? So these are questions, but the standard practice is a woman does not get married for 3 months, and that is a good idea anyway, because you should never get remarried on the rebound. It's good to to wait a little bit anyway. Let me also remind people that if a woman had an affair during her marriage, halachically she is not allowed to marry the man with whom she had an affair. Now, that's a very important bit of information to know, that so if a woman gets divorced in order to marry somebody else, according to halacha, if she had an affair with that person, even one time, even a one night stand with that person while she was married, she cannot marry that person. Right? So that's the Torah wants to discourage adultery, so it basically says if a woman falls in love with a guy that she's not married to, she just better wait until she gets a divorce, meaning she will not be permitted. This is the din of sota. A woman who commits adultery cannot stay married to her husband, nor can she marry the person with whom she had relations.
Would that be a sinful marriage then if she did?
Yeah, so that's another good example. If a woman, that's a good question. If a woman wrongfully, sinfully married the man that she committed adultery with, it is still a valid marriage, although a prohibited marriage, and she would need a get from the adulterer. It would not be like marrying a non-Jew, which is a nullity. The only marriages that are nullities are Jew to non-Jew, and God forbid an incestuous marriage. If God, I mean, you know, if somehow a brother married a sister not knowing, you don't need a get. Incestuous marriages are not marriages at all. Yep.
What if a man had an affair,
yeah,
and then he gave his wife a get? Is he allowed to marry a woman that he
has? Yes, yes. I know it goes back to the double standard, but yeah. But again, there is a logic to this. I'll tell you why.
What's the difference?
Well, the difference is very simple. The difference emanates from the fact. Now, I'm going to answer a question with a question in the time-honored Jewish. I'm going to tell you an answer that you're going to ask me a question on that, and that is, given the fact that male polygamy is permitted, so a man can have more than one wife. So the theory is, if a man is with another woman, his wife cannot complain because he would have the right to marry the other woman if he wanted to. So consequently, under the halachic definition of adultery, if a married man is with another woman who's not married, he is not committing adultery, because he has the right to marry that woman had they both chosen to do so. Now, I understand you're going to ask me that. Well, a man can commit adultery with a woman who is married,
but otherwise it's not adultery.
That is correct. I understand that you have a problem here, but all I will tell you is it is a logical consequence of the institution of male polygamy. Now, you're going to question, well, so why did the Torah allow that? Good question. But all I'm saying is, once you acknowledge that a man can have more than one wife, then it would stand to reason that he can't be guilty of adultery with a single woman, because he would have the right to marry that single woman.
So he doesn't marry her.
But his wife, that's kind of not his wife's business, meaning his wife cannot complain, you were unfaithful to me, because his response is, you know, you don't have a right to exclusivity
in that way. If a man
well, these days it is prohibited under the ban of Rabbeinu Gershom, but it's still not adultery. Say again?
It's in your
ketubah. So these days, you know, if Chas V'Shalom, a guy sticks around.
Okay. All right. So let me make a point. It is true. Okay, that's a very excellent point. Again, I'm glad you're coming up with this. It is the case that a man that's sleeping around with single women. Is not guilty of the sin of adultery. That is the case. But, you are correct that would entitle a woman to get a get. A woman can go to a Beis Din, and the Beis Din will order the man, if she so desires, to give her a get, because it's not considered to be a tolerable situation that a woman has to live with a disloyal husband. So, even though it's not adultery, and he's not prohibited from marrying his girlfriend, but his wife has the remedy, if that's a remedy, of demanding a get, and the Beis Din will order a get. Yeah, so, that is a point. So you see that things are not all or nothing, meaning it's not adultery, but it's still bad enough that the woman is entitled to get out and get her ketubah and everything else. But again, that's a second best thing, so to speak. Okay. But if a woman commits adultery if a married woman commits adultery, whoever the husband could be married or not the husband, the lover could be married or single, that makes no difference. But if the woman is married, she is disabled from living with the guy that she was with, right? That's the corollary of something.
Yeah. So is this why it's socially acceptable that men just basically sleep around and things, and the society wouldn't tell them anything? Is it halacha also wouldn't say anything?
Well, obviously, so here you we have to differentiate between the strict halacha and what you might call the ethics of Judaism. It's absolutely clear that a man that is not faithful to his wife is considered to be an immoral person, is considered to be a bad person, is a person who is sinning in the eyes of God. So the fact that something is technically not a violation of halacha is not the end of, you know.
What if he's unmarried?
If he's unmarried?
Yeah, if he's not married.
And he's just with women outside of marriage?
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
Now that you're asking me generally, what is the halacha of premarital sexual relationships? Okay, I'll address that. So that's a big machlokas. According to the Rambam, any sexual relationship between two Jews outside of marriage is a violation of one of the 613 commandments of the Torah. Because when the Torah says a man marries a woman and then they have relations, the implication is, the Rambam says, that sexual intercourse outside of marriage is prohibited. Now, it's not adultery, it's not a violation of the Ten Commandments, it's not as bad as adultery, but it is a sinful relationship, and therefore the Rambam absolutely says you cannot have sex outside of marriage. Now,
what if it's with a non-Jew?
That's even worse. I'm talking. No. That's a separate. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's worse. But I'm talking about even with Jew to Jew. Now, let me point out there's another hidden thing that people aren't aware of. And that is, okay, premarital sex is a negative prohibition. It's not a capital crime, etc. It's not adultery. But keep in mind that by and large today, single women do not go to the mikveh. Now that means, when a man has relations with a single woman, they're not just violating the laws against premarital sex. They are violating a much more severe law. They are violating the laws of Nida. And the laws of Nida are very, very severe. They are more severe.
I thought they only apply if you're married.
No.
Also, woman, because
no.
A man can just go to the
also
mikvah.
Also, prostitutes
next
to go nothing, to the mikvah.
No. One second. Nida is menstruation. So that's, in other words, if a man has relations with a woman who has had her period, even if her period was when she was 12 years old, she remains in a forbidden state of Nida until she goes to the mikvah. Now, given the fact, now in the time of the Talmud, let me point out, single women did go to the mikveh all the time. Not for sex. They went to the mikveh because they needed to be ritually pure to go to the temple and everything else. So it was entirely possible for a man to be with a woman who was ritually pure. But today, that's not going to happen. I mean, I'll discuss how it might happen sometimes, but generally speaking, it's not going to happen. Now, if that's not going to happen, you have to understand the prohibition, the avera, that a man and a woman both are committing when they are together is the sin of premarital intercourse, which is a negative commandment, but they are also committing the very severe infraction of Nida. So you need to factor that in. Now, because of this, I'll tell you a question that rabbis actually get today. Here's the issue. I actually had this question myself many years ago. And that is, let's say you have a couple comes to me, and the couple are living together. They're living together. Two Jewish people living together. Not married. And right now they're not ready to get married. But they're interested in becoming more religious. They're, you know, keeping more of Shabbos. They're keeping kosher. And let's say, you know, I tell them, get married. And they say, well, we're not ready to get married. So here is the thing. What should I advise them to do? If I tell them to get married, no. The answer is no. If I tell them, separate until you're married, the answer will also be no. So here's the question. They're committing a sin no matter what. But if I allow the single woman to go to the mikveh, that reduces the sin. It takes away the nida sin, and it leaves the lesser sin of premarital intercourse. So, would it be proper to kind of give them direction to, in other words, if somebody is doing an avera, and they're going to do the avera whether you like it or not, but you have a way of minimizing the avera by taking a component away. Now, I will tell you that rabbis are gatekeepers here, because basically, a mikveh will not allow a single woman to use the mikveh unless a rabbi specifically calls up and says, you know, we have tremendous power.
What if they
no.
say no?
Well, okay, they may not know. You're right. And a lot of times they just do it and no one's going to ask questions. But sometimes they know. So the question is, should a rabbi okay the use of a mikveh for single women if that would reduce the level of transgression? Now, this is a difficult question. I'm kind of inviting you into the mental process.
Yes.
On one hand, you could say, well, listen, if they don't go to the mikveh, they're committing a magnitude 5 sin. If they go to the mikveh, it only becomes a magnitude 1 sin. So it's better for me to knock it down, better for them. On the other hand, the problem is, by opening the mikveh to single people who are having a sexual relationship, that is kind of an official legitimation and approval of something that Judaism says is not a proper thing. So, in a sense, even if not giving them the use of the mikveh means they're committing a bigger sin, but it's necessary to take a stand. I mean, I'll give you an analogy. Analogous.
So you would tell them not to use the mikveh.
Well, that would be the issue. Now, perhaps we would say, well, go to a mikveh where they think you're married and use it. But I cannot openly say single people in a sexual union can use the mikveh. I'll give you a similar example in secular society, which Halacha would talk about as well. The issue of giving, and again, forgive me for being frank, but these are important issues. The issue of giving condoms to high school students to prevent the spread of AIDS. Now, the issue there is, kids are having sexual relationships one way or the other. So this way, the condoms will prevent them from getting AIDS. So we might as well save lives. On the other hand, when you're giving condoms, instead of teaching abstinence, you're giving an approval of behavior that is immoral.
But the science already shows that they're not going to have any more sex because you give them condoms.
I understand, but it's not even a question of they're doing more, but it's a question of you're accepting the immoral as the normal.
It's what's true, though. Otherwise, you're just pretending it doesn't exist.
I understand. But the question becomes, does morality depend to some degree on at least adhering to a certain standard? You know, that's a difficult issue. If I look at someone as an individual, it's better for them to have a condom than not to have a condom. But if I look at the message that I'm sending to everybody, you know, it's not so clear. Mikvah is the same, you know, same thing. I mean, if people would think that the mikvah is open for those who have a sexual union outside of marriage, you know, what message are you sending? So different rabbis go different ways on this. This is not a simple question. Some rabbis will open the mikvah to single people who are committed. Other rabbis will say not. But again, it's a hidden trap that people don't realize. That the averos that are being done when you have sex outside of marriage are not only premarital sex, they are the much more severe laws of Nida. Yeah.
So what about the question of, you have two Jews who got married, but they did not have a halachic marriage.
Yes.
Would a rabbi guide them to use a mikvah or not?
Yeah. Well,
technically not.
Yeah. I hear what you're saying. There, they think they are married.
Think
they are. So there, that's a much easier problem because
they are though, because they probably get to exchange rings.
Yeah. Well, okay. So there are two things. Number one, this happens all the time.
Yeah.
We just remarry them, and it's nice. They renew their vows.
But what if they're not open to that idea? They think
okay.
They're married.
So if they're not open, as you just said, in many many ways, there are various halachic principles that say that even a non-kosher wedding might theoretically be deemed kosher in this way. I'll tell you why. Because one of the ways that a Jewish marriage could be affected is by physical consummation. And if religious Jews know that they are living together as husband and wife, that may create a halachic marriage. So in many cases, what started off as a non-halachic marriage becomes a halachic marriage. And therefore, there's much less of a problem in encouraging them to use the mikveh. In fact, I would say it's proper to, as opposed to the people who are clearly living out of wedlock. Very, very difficult. You see, this is our problem in life today is that we often, Rabbanim and Poskim, we often have to decide between the lesser of two evils. The choice is not between good and bad. The choice is between bad and worse. And the question becomes, well, is it better for me to legitimate an out of wedlock prohibited union by giving them mikveh? Or should I stand up for the halacha, even though that's condemning them to a much, much worse aveira than would be the case had they gone to the mikveh? Right? These are those types of problems that we grapple with. And again, this comes up, this type of problem that comes up a lot. I mean, I'll give you another example which has nothing to do with this, but it's the same principle. Inviting people for Shabbos when you know they're going to drive. Now, driving on Shabbos, we're going to assume, is a sin. Well, you can discuss what the aveira is, but the burning of fuel in an internal combustion engine is burning on Shabbos. Okay, so it's a davar pashut, right? You don't drive on Shabbos. Okay, we just take that as a given. Now, I'm inviting somebody to my house. Now, obviously, I would like them to come for 24 hours and come Friday afternoon and don't leave Saturday night. And if I can do that, that's gabaldic, you know, that's wonderful. But, you know, they don't want to come for 24 hours. And I offer them a place. They don't want it. They want to come Shabbat afternoon and they want to leave, you know, 2 hours later. Now, on one hand, if they come and they spend the Shabbos, you know, number one, at least for a few hours, they're doing mitzvahs for a few hours. Kiddush and benching, and zemiros and hamotzi, which they wouldn't be doing had they been. So even for the immediate Shabbos, there are certain gains. And number two, it's not just the immediate Shabbos, but a Shabbos, I'm sure many of you have experiences like this, that the Shabbos is one of the powerful ways that brings a person to the Torah. So, on the other hand, when I invite them, I'm causing them to commit a sin in order to get to me. On the other hand, if I wouldn't invite them, they might be driving to the beach or to the mall or to the movie theater or whatever it is. So, once again, the question becomes about encouraging aveirot, sins, in order to minimize other sins that might be done and that might be worse, both now and in the future. So all I can tell you is, and you know, I mean, Chabad is obviously very, very lenient on this issue, but not only Chabad, even other organizations, other Orthodox movements tend to say that if it's a mechanism that can bring a person closer to Hashem, we have to look at the long term. Or I'll give you another example of this idea. There's a law in the Shulchan Aruch, and you may not have heard this law. You're not allowed to give food to somebody if they're not going to make a bracha. Did you ever hear this law? That if I have a non-religious person in my house and they're not going to make a bracha, I'm not allowed to give them food because I'm causing them to sin by eating food without a bracha. Now that's what the Shulchan Aruch says. That's in the Shulchan Aruch.
That's bad hospitality.
So here is what Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach said, one of the great, great poskim. He said, imagine the situation here in Israel, let's say. It's 100 degrees outside. Your air conditioner is kaput. You call in a repairman, a non-religious repairman, who's working, you know, 2 hours in the hot, humid weather to repair your air conditioner. And you don't offer him even a glass of water because he doesn't make a bracha. What is he going to think of you? What is he going to think about your religious Jew? You wear a yarmulke or the woman wears a shetel or a tichel. So Shlomo Zalman said, his hatred and resentment of religious Jews is going to result in many, many more sins than the isolated sin of not making a bracha. And if you give him water and you show hospitality, that may change his attitude. He may look at religious Jews as nice people and gracious people. And perhaps, no guarantees, perhaps it plants a seed. So Shlomo Zalman Orbach said, it's a tunnel vision. It's a very courageous psak in a sense, because it's departing from the Shulchan Aruch. It's a tunnel vision to simply say, oh, I can't allow this because I'm causing him to sin, because he's eating without a bracha. But I have to look at the fact that not causing him to sin here may actually cause many, many greater sins in the future, but his hatred of Judaism and the like. And that's the same idea with Shabbos. Not inviting somebody for Shabbos may prevent them from becoming closer and closer to Judaism. And similarly, you know, denying the mikveh to the it's the same type of problem. May mean I'm not legitimating their sin, but on the other hand, it may mean I'm pushing them away from becoming closer and closer to Hashem. So these are hard questions, right? These are hard questions. That sometimes there is a concept that we allow what is sinful because in the long run it'll produce greater spirituality. But that's a very dangerous idea, you see, because that's almost saying the ends justify the means. What about telling people, you know, to drive to shul? You know, we don't tell them to drive to shul, etc., right? We don't say, oh, come to shul. So, I mean, even Chabad would never tell somebody, you know, drive to shul. They extend general invitations, and whoever comes. But they don't say, you know, hey, you weren't in shul, I want you to drive, you know, drive this week. I mean, no rabbi is going to ever speak like that, you see? So this is what we deal with. This is the issue of not bad versus good, but, you know, bad versus worse. That's the question of what's going to be worse. And this is a difficult judgment, okay? And this is why rabbis get paid so much, because we have to make these difficult decisions. Okay, all right. I don't know, I'm getting far afield here, but I hope this is useful food for thoughts and the like. Okay. But be it as it may, I will tell you that the one case that I did allow a single woman to go to the mikveh, they did get married, like, you know, 10 months later, Baruch Hashem. I mean, they happened to get divorced 5 years later, but that was unrelated. I hope that's unrelated and the like. But at least for a while, things went very, very well for them in that way, and it was definitely a step in their becoming more religious. And in fact, I'll tell you a non-Hasidic precedent for this. You've heard of the great Rav Yisrael Salanter, who was the founder of the Musar, which emphasized interpersonal relationships and sensitivity and the like. So although he was a Lithuanian Jew from Vilna, so he was totally from a Torah community, but he spent a lot of his life wandering through the cities of France and Germany, where there were very few religious Jews. And before outreach was a big deal, he was involved on a one-to-one in bringing Jews to Torah. So in one of the ports, one of the German ports in the North Sea, Königsberg, all of the longshoremen were Jews. It's interesting. I know Salonika in Greece also, all the longshoremen were Jews. But I have to tell you, this is a credit to the Sephardim. The Greek Jews were Sephardim, and Salonika, which was the busiest port in Greece, was closed on Saturday, because none of the longshoremen would unload cargo on Shabbos. That was in Salonika. Königsberg, which was Ashkenazic Jews, were unfortunately not so committed, and they did their job on Shabbos. So Rabbi Yisrael Salanter spent hours and hours with them, teaching them that if they unload the cargo with a shinoi, they do it not in the exact normal way, they can downgrade their prohibition from a Torah violation to a rabbinic violation. And he felt it was worthwhile not only to take people away from sin, but to make the sin less severe. It was a worthwhile endeavor. Because he didn't say, oh, you're sinning anyway, who cares about you? Rather, he said, minimizing the Avera is worthwhile. And that would be a direct precedent, I think, to going to the mikveh for single people and the like. That you don't have the attitude, if they're doing an Avera anyway, I don't care about what happens to them, right? So that, I think, is a precedent for that type of thing. Okay, let me just see. Maybe this is a logical place to stop. Okay. So anyway, let me just tell you what we're going to be discussing. In other words, we're going to be discussing the issue we had one session on it already, of the aguna, and that is the woman who has a civil divorce, but her husband refuses to give her a religious divorce. This is a very, very serious problem. It may not be numerically so serious. Sometimes the numbers that they say are women that are agunos are exaggerated a little bit. But even if there's one woman that's stuck, for her, it's a very, very serious problem. And if people are suffering, it's a problem for the Jewish people to try to address. And we will discuss the different things that can be done, prenuptial agreements, the use of beis din, annulments that sometimes don't require a get, and the like. So we're going to kind of go through them. Some of them are very controversial and not always accepted. Some of them are more mainstream. There's even some secular laws that have been enacted in the state of New York and in South Africa and in England. It's kind of all the same, that protect agunos, that try to use the secular power of society to protect aguna. Now the word aguna, just grammatically, the word aguna, igun, means anchor. Anchor. So when a woman is anchored, a woman is stuck, she is called an aguna. A man can also be stuck. If a woman doesn't want to receive a get, and the man is called an agun. Now, there are two types of agunot. Type 1 aguna is a totally different problem. That is when the husband is missing and we're not sure if he's dead or alive. Now that is a very serious aguna issue. This happened after the concentration camps, where we just didn't hear about people. This happens even in Israel today, unfortunately, when soldiers or even civilians are kidnapped and held for many years, and we don't know if they're dead or alive. Is there any point that their wives can remarry? Now, secular law has a rule that an unexplained absence for 7 years allows for a presumption of death. Meaning, a guy disappears for 7 years, we assume that he's dead. Jewish law does not have an automatic rule like that. Jewish law says, unless you're like 95 or something, Jewish law basically says, just because you're gone, we're not allowed to assume you're dead. So that's, we'll call that a type 1 aguna. Type 1 aguna is unexplained absence. And how do you prove death? And that is a very serious problem even today. But the type 2 aguna is, we know where the husband is. He's around. But the problem is, he is refusing to give a get. He's refusing to give a get out of spite. Well, there are a lot of reasons why he's refusing to give a get. Sometimes, although this is not the most common reason, a husband genuinely wants reconciliation. Sometimes. Usually that's not the case, but sometimes, I want to be married. Sometimes, it's the other way around. He just wants to inflict pain. I want to hurt her. I want her to suffer. That's the malicious. And other times, it is really blackmail or extortion, meaning I'll give her a get, but only if she meets certain demands. In the most gross form, it might be she has to give me $100,000 or more. Sometimes it'll be she gives me all the property, give me the house, give me everything that we own jointly. Or it might be give me custody of the children. So you can pick, woman, you can choose what you want. Do you want to get, or do you want your kids? You can only have one and not the other. Right? So we have three personalities here. We have the personality who wants reconciliation. We have the personality who just wants to inflict pain. And if he doesn't care what he gets, you can give him $1 million, then he's not going to give her again. Those are the hardest nuts to crack, actually. And then you have the one that is the extortionist or the blackmailer. Meaning he has a price, but you just have to make his give his price. Right? Now all three are difficult situations, and the question becomes, how does halacha deal with these situations, and what do we do? What can we do for the woman without compromising the get procedure? itself. Okay, so that's what we're going to be talking about for the next week and maybe the next 2 weeks. Yeah.
Is it only the husband that can give the wife a get?
Yes. So this is the thing. See, here you have to understand this right off the bat. Unless there's an annulment, which we'll talk about, an annulment can be very interesting. The get procedure is not like a secular divorce. In a secular divorce, who grants the divorce? It's the court. The court grants the divorce. It's not that husband divorces wife or wife divorces husband. They file papers in the court, and it is the court that says the marriage is over. In halacha, although there is a beis din for a get, the beis din is there, but a beis din does not end the marriage. The beis din supervises a ceremony where the husband or his agent must physically deliver the get to the wife. It moves one way from husband to wife. That is the only way a get procedure works. Now again, I'm going to answer your question with a question. Why is that so? Answer, it is symmetrical to marriage. Why is marriage that way? But marriage works exactly the same way, right? Husband gives ring to wife. That makes the marriage. Husband gives get to wife. That breaks the marriage. There's divorce works the same way marriage works.
So if he didn't want to be married, but she did, he could just give her a get and they won't be married.
Okay, so now let me explain something. Under biblical law, a husband could divorce a wife without her permission. He could just give her a get. But, the ban of Rabbeinu Gershom that came into effect in the 1100s did two things. It prohibited a man from marrying two wives, and it prohibits a man from divorcing a woman without her consent. So today, therefore, the get does require mutual consent. The husband gives a get to his wife, but she has to agree to take it. That is why, potentially, a man can also be an agun. If a man wants to give a get and she doesn't want to take it, he's stuck too.
That's widely accepted.
Huh?
That's widely accepted everywhere.
What? Yes. Well, among Ashkenazim, so Sfaradim don't. Sfaradim allow polygamy, and Sfaradim will still allow that. But among Ashkenazim, it's totally accepted. Yeah. Okay. So we'll discuss that. So there is a small percentage of men who are disabled, but we'll talk about how that works.
Still live.
Okay. Yeah. No, but it is a tough situation. But yeah. Well, again, as I say, I mean, some of the reasons are hard for us to understand. It is very true. I mean, I will be honest with you that obviously I've been learning these halachos for many, many, many years. And to give you full explanation that makes sense to our limited understanding, I'm not going to be able to give you a full explanation. But at least what my goal here is, not so much to justify Hashem's Torah. Hashem's Torah does not need our justification. But I want you to be informed, so at least you know what it says, and you know what the halacha says, and then, you know, you'll be aware of the options. That within the framework that may seem very harsh, there are still things that can be done to help people that are suffering, so it's at least important to be aware of all of that, okay? Alrighty, have a good week, and you be well. Okay.